Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, July 29th, and the National Broadcasting Company begins its network operations for today with a roundup of the latest news. We will hear from members of our foreign staff and from Richard Harkness in Washington. First, to the Middle East, to Cairo, to hear from Grant Parr.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. The drive launched by the British, Australians, and South Africans on the northern sector of the front Sunday night wound up Monday night without substantial gain. There was nothing but the ordinary patrolling and a little shelling yesterday. After taking part in the bombing of Tobruk Monday night, United States Army Air Force heavy bombers were busy again last night hundreds of miles in another direction. Raiding Ceuta Bay in Crete at dusk, the American warplanes blasted Axis shipping. During the early days of the German attack in Libya, considerable numbers of barges were seen in the Gulf of Bomba, 55 miles west of Tobruk. With these, said some astute observers, the Germans intended to land troops around Tobruk and storm the harbor defenses. The Nazis did indeed try to land some of these barges west of Tobruk, but a small British naval vessel drove them off. Whether they contained men or supplies has never been determined. In any event, the Africa Corps got Tobruk without using barges. But even though they never assumed the spectacular role of invasion craft, these small boats have played an important part in Rommel's supply scheme. For the past 4 days, British long-range fighters and light bombers have been attacking small Axis vessels, which have been moving supplies out of Tobruk and Bardia to Sidi Barrani. Yesterday was the biggest day yet for this barge baiting. Fighters attacked first with cannon and machine guns and raked the 75-foot motor-propelled craft from stem to stern. One barge suddenly burst into flames and soon sank. It had apparently been loaded with gasoline for Rommel's trucks and tanks. The barges struck back with AK-AK guns and machine guns, but the raiders wouldn't be driven off. Another formation, this time including light bombers, now attacked. And three bombs were landed so close to barges, they must have been damaged. Two bombs hit near the stern of one vessel, probably sank it. British subjects in Egypt, about 30,000 in all, began registration today at their consulate. This move will make possible immediate application of the bill, now pending in Parliament, specifying registration and liability to conscription for British subjects resident abroad. Both men and women between the ages of 16 and 60 are affected, as workers for war posts other than military are also sought. I now return you to New York.
Now to the British capital, here is John McVane reporting from the BBC studios in London.
This is London. A strong force of British bombers last night hammered the great German port of Hamburg again. A lot of cloud formations laid over the city, but a number of bomber crews went below the clouds into the heavy anti-aircraft fire to carry out their bombing runs. They reported that they saw large fires blazing. 32 bombers are missing. Only a small number of German raiders came over eastern England during the night. The Admiralty announced today that 6,178,681 tons of German and Italian shipping had been captured, sunk, or damaged up to June 30th, 1942. This doesn't take in losses inflicted by the Russians, which are estimated at 750,000 tons. The increased number of German raiders over Britain night before last is taken by some British observers as proving that the Germans are worried by RAF raids on Germany. The scattered attacks had one good effect here. They gave people the feeling that they were really in the war again. Even the sound of London's anti-aircraft guns acted as a tonic on Londoners. A reminder that after all, the war is not something that is happening in distant Russia and distant Egypt. Of probably no other people in history but the British, could it be said that a few hard raids at this particular time would act as a stimulant to their morale. At the moment, the British are beset with the feeling that they're not taking enough part in the battle. Most of the people talking and listening at these second front demonstrations have heard plenty of bombs. The fact that they haven't been hearing them lately makes them fretful for more action. British leaders certainly know well that the great mass of the people are spoiling for a fight. The problem is to make the best use of this mass offensive spirit, to harness it to the Allied striking force that can tip the actual war scales. Today, the authoritative London Times says the military situation in the United Nations is graver than at any time since the summer of 1940. The Times goes on to explain that Germany and the whole strength of the United Nations are racing against time, and the paper declares that considerations of British and American safety must not be allowed to stand in the way of a decision on what form of help can be given to Russia in this critical hour. The Times says strategy can't be conducted by mass meetings, and London and Washington must carry out a united policy. Nevertheless, the Times asserts, the men who on the British side bear at this moment the responsibility for a momentous decision are in the main the men who have been responsible for the supreme direction of the war over the past 2 years. And the Times warns that the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of the support given Russia in her hour of peril will be taken as the acid test of the ability and foresight with which the conduct of the war has been planned and developed. The Times editorial is important. It means that a body of sound, intelligent, conservative opinion believes that the time has come for Britain and America to undertake the greatest risk to help their ally, Russia. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
That was John McVane in London. And now, across the far reaches of the Pacific, Martin Agransky is standing by somewhere in Australia. We switch to him now.
This is Martin Agransky, somewhere in Australia. Yesterday, the Jap overland coast guard, our Papuan base at Fort Moresby, was touched for the first time by our ground patrol. They hit and pushed back the Japs' advanced combat patrol in the mountain jungle around Kokoda, about 65 miles from Moresby. Though no details of the action are available, a GHQ spokesman today described the Jap patrols as, I quote, strong, unquote. Thus, it is only logical that our own patrols must have been of a substantial size to drive the Japs back. At the same time, our Air Force was joined, where the Japs made their landing last Tuesday night with three heavy attacks. In each raid, our Douglas Dodge bombers and B-26 medium bombers carried out low-level attacks, making numerous hits on Jap supply dumps and finishing up with heavy ground scraping of Jap troops when their bombs ran out. The GHQ spokesman stated flatly today that, I quote, there has so far been no evidence that the enemy has been reinforced at Goma, unquote. If this is correct, it means our Air Force has at least proved strong enough so far to prevent seaborne reinforcements from reaching Goma, even though it did not prevent the landing itself. Near Kokoda, the enemy is beginning to run into about the toughest fighting terrain in the world. The 65 miles from Kokoda to Moresby is described as a country where the trails, which have not been dry in living memory, usually run with a 60-degree tilt along gorges between 4 and 9,000 feet deep, where bridges are slippery tree trunks across roaring whitewater rivers and cascades, where even level roads are inches deep in mud, as greasy as mutton fat, where even natives at night surround their camps with moats to protect them against snakes, scorpions, and giant rats, where every inch of progress calls for almost superhuman endeavor against natural obstacles. For these reasons, the Jap overland threat against Moresby may not be as serious as the Japs' quick progress in the relatively easy country between Goma and Kokoda makes it seem. For all informed observers, the danger of the Jap invasion of Goma resolves into this. First, that the Japs have beat us to the punch. Our own offensive against the Jap in New Guinea becomes now immeasurably more difficult, as the Goma area contains airfield sites which seem logically the first objective to aim at in beginning a New Guinea invasion. And second, that if our Air Force proved unable to prevent even the small-scale landing at Goma, what certainty can there be that it could prevent a really large-scale seaborne invasion attempt much nearer to Port Moresby on the Papuan coast? We must have more planes here just to defend our advanced bases on this front. If we can't attack, we must at least be able to defend. This is Martin Agransky signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
Events at home are reported now by Richard Harkness of Philadelphia Inquirer's Washington Bureau, so we take you to our nation's capital.
Washington is full of talk about a second front. The discussion is almost as prevalent here as it is in London. The talk in Washington centers around possible action by the United States and Britain at any one of three points. We may strike at the Germans in France, or perhaps in Norway, or possibly in Morocco to take the Nazi pressure off the Russians. Of course, talk about a second front is speculation. You and I aren't going to know about it until it actually happens. The first word we'll get will come from an official communique telling us that our men are fighting Hitler on the continent of Europe. Military men here say a frontal attack on France would be the most effective, but it's the most difficult, too. In the first place, our forces would have to cross the English Channel, something Hitler can't do. In the second place, reports from France say Hitler has perhaps 400,000 men in this area. He has a second line of forts back from the coast to stop parachutists. On the other hand, the British commandos have shown that a landing in France is possible. Now, Norway is the next possibility. The coast there is rocky and forbidding. This attack would need longer shipping lines, but it would also catch the Germans away from their main bases. Here, too, we would find active help from the civilian population. But once landed in Norway, the Allied army would still find Germany across the water. Then there's Morocco. This point has its advantages and also its disadvantages. Morocco is on the north coast of Africa, you know. We can get men and machines there across the South Atlantic. On the other hand, American and British forces would meet a hostile population. Now, Morocco is not important in itself, but once established there, we could hit hard and straight at Italy. Besides the talk, spot news in Washington centers today on a second front. The president says we have 4 million men, more or less, under arms, and that a good many of them are serving overseas now. A diversion of shipping from the Caribbean Sea, a diversion apparently meant to carry more arms to Britain and Russia, may bring a serious shortage of sugar here at home. Now, also touching on the second front is the fact that the Navy has announced no ship sinkings in the last 24 hours. The right of the 8 German spies to a civil trial will be weighed by the Supreme Court today. It meets at noon to hear arguments by the defense that Hitler's killers should not be tried by the army. Unless the court intervenes, the military trial will resume tomorrow.
Fighting continues along the Russian front. Robert Magadov, NBC reporter in the Soviet capital, brings us now first-hand reports. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magadov speaking from Moscow. I'm glad to be able to report to you this morning the first signs of a stiffening Russian resistance in the crucial Don River battle. Not that the situation has already improved, by no means. The Germans continue to press outwards in the Bataysk area along the Rostov-Baku railway, and also eastward, trying to join up with the forces driving from Novocherkassk. Further east in the Semlyanskaya area, the enemy has advanced in several sectors, but the German progress along the Don River banks has been slowed down and is accompanied by greater losses. The Russians have apparently brought up some fresh reinforcements here, with the result that the Red Army in the Bataysk zone has much more punching power, while at Semlyanskaya, Russian counterattacks are more frequent and stubborn. Good news keeps pouring in from Voronezh, where the Russians are clearing the city district step by step, simultaneously recapturing further territory to the northwest and southwest of Voronezh. The miraculous city of Leningrad is beginning to stir again. The Germans nearly took it by storm last year, but they were battered down to impotence before its very gates. They tried to reduce the city to submission by bombing, shelling, hunger, and cold. But Leningrad emerged out of the ordeal unconquered and fighting back. Some of its splendid buildings and monuments have been ruined, and shells and bombs continue their deadly work pretty nearly every day now. But the city goes on producing for the front, erecting ever new fortifications and launching counterattacks, such as the one yesterday when a settlement was recaptured. The theaters, movies, and parks of Leningrad are functioning, and pretty girls sell flowers in the streets. Goodbye from Moscow.
These were reports by Grant Parr from Cairo, John McVane from London, Martin Agransky from Australia, Richard Harkness from Washington, and Robert Magadov from Moscow. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.